Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I am Joe McCormick. And today we're going to be kicking off a series about the topic of dust. I came to this one along a quite literal route. I was recently cleaning out some boxes that I had stored in a closet for years, and in the process stirred up a bunch of dust. And then I just sat there breathing it while I was going through all my old stuff, trying to, you know, figure out what to get rid of and all that. And this process greatly irritated my airways, but through the irritation, I ended up thinking a lot about dust and about what dust means to us. So we're surrounded by dust all the time. You know, it's in all of our homes. And it's a major concern of simple cleanliness and hygiene in the house, but it's also of huge significance to the natural environment, to cycles of weather and water. And it is of great significance to our health. Dust has so much influence on our lives. And yet it's interesting that when you think about the way dust imagery is used in, like, you know, metaphors and poetry and mythology and all that, it seems to me that what dust is most often used to symbolize is uselessness, worthlessness, meaninglessness, things of no lasting significance.
Yeah, I picked up Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable, just looking up dust and seeing what kind of, like, maybe old antiquated terminology and sayings might be invoked there. And sure enough, there was one for referring to money as dust, which I had not run across before. Like, the idea being like, it's money, it's ultimately worthless, and therefore you call it dust.
Wielding vocabulary in that way is like a talisman against the power of money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Examples of this kind of usage of dust meaning that which is worthless, meaningless, you know, of no lasting significance. These go back to ancient myths and religious literature. But one of the most famous examples that came to my mind is in Shakespeare's Hamlet. It's the quintessence of dust monologue in Act 2, Scene 2, where Hamlet is talking to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, and he says famously, "What a piece of work is a man, how noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form and moving, how express and admirable, in action, how like an angel, in apprehension, how like a god, the beauty of the world, the paragon of animals, and yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust?" So the final thought there is kind of the negation of everything he said beforehand. Despite all of the amazing powers of humankind, our beauty, our the way in which we are made in the image of God, according to Hamlet, ultimately, mankind is as worthless and meaningless as the dust from which it was made. And this betrays a kind of running theme of obsession with physical death, which sort of neutralizes all meaning and renders everything pointless. I guess when Hamlet is in his depressive moods.
Yeah, I mean, there's of course the line in the Bible, the King James Version being, "For dust thou art, and unto dust thou shalt thou return," which, you know, is pretty on point, but I think it also misses all of the dust in between, because as we'll be discussing, like, dust is just so ubiquitous. It's not just like that thing at the beginning and the end, like it's everywhere in between too. Like it's in the living body, it's brought into the living body, it's in the living world, and it's out there in the cosmos.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's kind of a beautiful observation. I like that counterpoint that, of course, life in many ways is dust. There is a dust of life in the same way that there is a dust of death. But I also still think that it's intriguing and curious that there's so much literature and poetry and stuff where the image of dust seems to emphasize almost cosmic horror, you know, the great vast emptiness and negation of all of life's grandiose illusions of worth. Like, why is that? What is it about, if you look at a pile of dust, what is it about a pile of fine granular particles of matter that takes on such a powerfully depressing symbolic heft?
Yeah, fear and a handful of dust, right?
So I guess a good place to start for the series is to tackle the question quite literally, what is dust in a physical sense? And I found that in scientific usage, the stuff that we call dust is often broken down with more specific terminology depending on the field. But I did find a book, actually, that gave what I thought was a really good definition of dust generally. So I came across this because I was reading an interview in Wired magazine with an author named Jay Owens. She's the author of a 2023 book called Dust, The Modern World in a Trillion Particles. And I like the author's thoughts, so I ended up buying the book to explore the topic more. And by the way, this book isn't purely about like the science of dust. It delves into politics and religion and philosophy and so forth. But in terms of a physical definition, the definition of dust the author uses is tiny flying particles. This is sort of a compromise that works across multiple domains. And personally, I think it works quite well because it captures the three main properties common to all the things we call dust. So tiny flying particles. First, we look at particles, meaning pieces of solid matter. In the atmospheric sciences, people often talk about the idea of aerosols, meaning particles or droplets that are suspended in the air, like suspended within a gas. But this includes things that obviously aren't what people mean by dust, such as floating liquid droplets like mist or fog. And many types of air pollution contain a mix of liquids and solid particulates. But in common usage, I think dust means a substance made mostly of solid particles.
Right.
Second element of tiny flying particles, we can look at tiny. There is no universally agreed upon size for dust particles, but based on reading Owens and other sources, it seems that what we call dust is always made of particles less than a millimeter in diameter, and usually on a scale of 100 to 1,000 times smaller than a millimeter, which means between 1 and 10 micrometers or microns in size. So again, a micrometer is 1/1,000th of a millimeter. And for comparison, Owens notes that human hair is on average somewhere between 70 and 90 micrometers in width. So if I did the math on this right, what we call dust is usually somewhere between 1% to about 15% the width of a human hair.
Right. So very often the particles of dust we're talking about, they're not even really visible to the human eye. Though again, you're going to have some particles that are larger than others.
Exactly. And they're things that are often not visible on their own, but are visible in aggregate.
Right. So like when you walk in and you decide to sit down at your hobby table, I don't know, your typewriter, whatever area of your house is beloved, but perhaps neglected, and you say, "Who put all this dust here?" You know, you're not going to think of it in terms of who put all of these dust particles here on my hobby table. You know, it's you see it again in aggregate, like you said. And how did they get there? Well, that goes right into your next point.
Right. So the third part of Owen's definition, tiny flying particles, is flying. So a core element of dust is that dust particles can easily be stirred up by airflow and other types of physical agitation. And then they float in the atmosphere for a significant time before settling down. So you might think of, say, grains of sand on the beach as tiny particles. But a lot of those grains are large enough that if you grab a fistful of sand off of a beach, you throw it up in the air, those grains of sand will plummet straight back down to the ground. However, some of the mass of that fistful of sand will probably be made up of dust-sized particles, which will remain in the air as a cloud for some time while the larger grains just fall to the earth. So a characteristic feature of dust is its ability to float in the air, but also to travel on the air. So this made me think about how when you see a surface in your house, maybe a bookshelf, covered in dust, you don't look directly above it to see where the dust was falling from. Maybe you do if you see larger pieces of something on top of it. But if it's just dust, we understand that dust migrates on currents of air and it settles somewhere potentially very far from its origin. So it doesn't just fall, but it travels.
Yeah.
So that's the rundown of Owen's definition, and I think it's a good one. Dust is made of tiny flying particles. But there's another sense of the question, what is dust? And that sense is, what is it made of? And this is another interesting point that Owens raises in the introduction of her book. She argues that dust is also defined by, quote, a certain loss of context, an inherent formlessness. And that might sound maybe overly poetic, but I think that's actually a quite good specific point. It's the fact that dust is made of many different substances, and we don't know what they are, and that is what makes it dust. Because if we did know exactly what it was made of, and we saw it, say, pouring in fine floating grains from its original source, we probably wouldn't call it dust. We would call it whatever it was. We might say, look, that is oak pollen, or that is pet dander floating off of my dog, or that is silica powder coming out of a container, or it's, you know, concrete dust coming up off of concrete being mixed in a bucket. It is the loss of its original context and the mixing together with other such substances lost from their original context, that blending together that makes these unknown particles simply dust.
Yeah, it's only in the Hollywood context that you have a definite source of dust. I was looking around at some of these gadgets earlier. You can pick up like a hand crank dust gun for pretty cheap, and then you have, you know, far more advanced models as well, where you would actually have the dust particles inside of a reservoir, and then you are spraying them out onto a surface. So, you know, you can get that like nice haunted manor layer of dust so that your lead actor can come in, you know, perhaps drag their finger over the surface of a piano and then look around at the haunted surroundings. But then you have to do another take and spend several minutes like removing all the dust and then reapplying the dust. I've heard accounts of that sort of thing in movie production before.
Now, what about when the actor who's like been through a lot, like, you know, they're coming in out of the desert or something and they pat themselves and the dust comes off of them in a cloud? I wonder, do they have to get redusted again each take?
I bet so. I mean, there's all sorts of it's kind of the reverse of the whole like having to polish Darth Vader's helmet, you know, constantly to make sure that you're not getting any smudges on there or anything. But yeah, if you're interested in the cinematic dusting, yeah, you can go to various websites and you can look up the movie dust. You can buy it in various sizes, various instruments to spray the movie dust around. It's kind of fun. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. AstaproAllergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay. Picture this, it's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road, the steeper the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, so dust is the name for tiny flying particles from an unknown source. But when we actually get in there with the microscope and the lab equipment, we of course can study dust and figure out where it comes from and what it's made of. So what is dust most often made of when we encounter it? Of course, it depends where you're taking the sample from. Worldwide, Owen says the most prevalent type of dust is mineral in origin, so tiny grains of rock broken apart by natural processes or worn down by erosion. You know, they come from the rocks, the rock layers of Earth, and these minerals are borne aloft by winds and other, primarily by winds, but by whatever source agitates them. Inside a home, a lot of the dust you will find still does come from soil tracked in or blown in from the outside, but there are also non-soil particles carried in from outside, including pollen and particulates in the air that come from combustion, such as soot. Soot can be a big constituent of dust. Also, soot from any combustion happening inside the house. Cooking in the house is a large source of particles inside the air of a home. But also there are, I don't know, depending on your point of view, perhaps grosser sources of dust, but hair from humans and pets, dead skin cells from humans, as well as pet dander, you know, stuff coming off of the skin of pets. There are fibers from, you know, inorganic sources in the home, fibers from carpets, furniture, and clothing. Other organic particles like pieces of dead insects, wonderful little cockroach crumbs all over the house. And then just, you know, random stuff, tiny bits of random garbage like pieces of paper waste and plastic.
This episode is brought to you by dusting. Have you dusted today? Don't you want to now?
Oh, let me give you another reason. Because among all that, there is something else. Some part of the dust itself, which is alive and feeding and growing and living amongst us always, and that is dust mites. I got really interested in dust mites for this episode, so I wanted to do a little sidebar here on dust mites. So there are many types of mites. House dust mites are one particular branch of them, belonging to the family Pyroglyphidae. And I was trying to parse the name, that name through its Greek roots. Pyro is fire, and glyphid would seem to mean like carving. But then I found a source saying exactly what it means, and the name of the pyroglyphid mites comes from the fact that these dust mites can cause irritation on the skin, rashes and irritation on human skin, like burns from fires, like fire carvings on the skin. So house dust mites are microscopic bugs that can be found all throughout human dwellings. They are not insects. Instead, they are eight-legged arachnids, more closely related to spiders than to insects. They are microscopic and can possibly be seen without the aid of a microscope, but would rarely be noticed without visual magnification. Their body lengths are on the order of a few hundred micrometers. So these dust mites are in many human homes, living all around us. How do these dust mites make a living? What are they doing in our homes? You might be able to guess that by knowing the genus name of a couple of the most common varieties of house dust mites. That genus name is Dermatophagoides, skin eaters. They are skin eaters. Generally dead skin that has already flaked off of your body. So fortunately, you know, usually they can find something that's not still attached to you.
Yeah, polite skin eaters.
They hunt for these discarded rafts of mammal skin in the microforests of our homes, in carpets, mattresses, in the soft weave of furniture. But despite their tiny size and the fact that they're usually looking for stuff that has already fallen off of you, house dust mites and their feces are a major problem for humans. They are a major source of allergens within the home. In fact, according to one paper that I'm going to get to in just a second, pyroglyphid mites are the single greatest source of allergic symptoms in human beings, total. The authors of the paper estimate that they cause allergies in somewhere between 65 million and 1.2 billion people.
This episode is also brought to you by washing your sheets. Have you washed your sheets lately? Don't you want to now?
I want to clarify that these are different than bed bugs, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah, dust mites, I mean, they'll find them all over the place. They're not the same as bed bugs. You know, bed bugs are looking for a blood meal. The dust mites are looking for the skin flakes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's maybe a good point to describe what they look like. Rob, I've attached some pictures of dust mites for you. These are several micrographs of pyroglyphids. What do you see here?
I mean, they basically look like the head crabs from the old Half-Life video games.
That's perfect. That's exactly it. Yeah. Some of these are like scanning electron micrographs, I guess, that, you know, they're you get a lot of texture. It's false color, I guess. But in the one shown from right above, I mean, they've got a bit of a spidery appearance because they have eight legs and these, you know, these mouth parts up in the front, the kind of finger fangs sort of. Mm-hmm. But also one of these big pictures we have to look at, the skin just looks kind of like wrinkly and deflated. It's like a half inflated basketball.
Yeah, yeah. I also like how the wrinkle on this particular image looks kind of like a mouth. So it kind of looks like some sort of a whiskery Muppet creature, like from like a 90s Muppet creature, not a, like a classic Muppet.
Oh, it looks exactly like either the Nightmare Before Christmas, the Oogie Boogie Man, or looks like the Sorting Hat from the Harry Potter movies.
Yeah, yeah.
The really magnified images I have for you are the false color images, but the ones in true color, you can see that they're generally kind of white in appearance. Again, they're very, very small, so hard to see with the naked eye, but kind of white and a little bit grub-like in appearance, with, you know, the limbs coming out in the front and a larger sort of white bulb of a body extending behind.
Mm.
Now, I wanted to come back and take a brief look at a dust mite paper that I just brought up a minute ago. This is a paper called "Is Permanent Parasitism Reversible? Critical Evidence from Early Evolution of House Dust Mites." This is by Pavel B. Klimov and Barry O'Connor, published in Systematic Biology in 2013. And there were a couple of things I wanted to talk about here. First is just a passage directly about the allergenic quality of these mites, about why the feces of pyroglyphid mites are so prone to cause irritation and allergic reaction in humans. The authors write, quote, "Dust mites feed on organic debris, such as shed skin, and flourish in nests of vertebrates, including human dwellings. The mites' severe allergenic properties are linked to their powerful digestive and molting enzymes, salivary secretions, and other water-soluble molecules. For example, large quantities of digestive enzymes accumulate in mites' fecal material, minute particles that can easily become airborne. When inhaled or in contact with skin, the residual mite enzymes may break up tight junctions between epithelial cells and trigger allergic reactions." So these mites, they make tiny poops, and their tiny poops are full of the digestive enzymes that they use to break down their food. And their food is human skin flakes, and in the broader context, things that contain keratin, like, of course, skin cells, but also like bird feathers, which these animals also eat. So it is like they have evolved a digestive enzyme that makes it possible for them to eat difficult-to-digest things that fall off of us and get nutrition out of that. And then they poop, and their poop contains the enzymes that allow them to break that stuff down. And then that poop gets stirred up in the air and becomes part of the dust in our homes and gets on people's skin and in their airways and so forth. Hmm. But anyway, to come to a bigger picture issue, the real point of this paper is related to the evolutionary history of the house dust mite. How did these microscopic animals end up living this way, crawling through the jungles of the couch cushions, you know, getting into the area rug to munch on our dead skin flakes? How did they end up that way? Well, the authors of this paper used genomic evidence, cross-comparing different lineages of mites, of these pyroglyphids and related organisms, to show that these free-living mites within our homes used to be even closer companions than they are now. They evolved from fully obligate permanent parasites of warm-blooded vertebrates like birds and mammals. The authors write, quote, "We propose that parasitic ancestors of pyroglyphids shifted to nests of vertebrates. Later, the nest-inhabiting pyroglyphids expanded into human dwellings to become a major source of allergens." Mm. So these evolved from creatures that were once free-living organisms and then evolved a tight, specialized parasite relationship with warm-blooded vertebrates like mammals and birds and would live directly on the host, and then shifted away from that tight, specific parasitic relationship to have a more loose relationship, to be free living and to somewhat, you know, to sort of scavenge what falls off of the host animal or the former host animal. And that's interesting because this kind of despecialization from a tight parasite host relationship to a more generalized free living dust nomad lifestyle was considered quite unusual, something that is rarely observed in evolution and at some times in the past was thought impossible, but it's clearly not impossible. It's just evolutionarily difficult to do, to get out of that sort of tight adaptive dead end where you are stuck in a relationship with this host animal, to become a little more of a generalist and get a little bit more distance and still be able to survive.
Well, it's almost like evolutionarily they survive the passage to the promised land being the augmented environment that is the human home.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I mean, they still have to be very specialized to survive within the human home. They have to be able to tolerate different kinds of environmental conditions than they would if they were living directly on the mammal or the bird body. Like they have to be able to tolerate less reliability. And I think one of the things is they have to be more resistant to dehydration, you know, because like it's harder to get water when you're just living in the dust. They have to have these digestive enzymes that allow them to break down difficult foods like the keratin and skin cells and stuff like that. But apparently they got all the right adaptations and now they're here. Now they're living in the couch cushion.
Yeah, it's my understanding that humidity is key. You look around and you see various advice about dust mites in the home. And like some people advise having a dehumidifier, for example, drying things out a bit. And then on top of that, of course, washing sheets and so forth to appropriate temperatures. And some people advocate like putting... I guess in cases where you don't have time to do this and you're dealing perhaps with, you know, some sort of a more severe allergy to them, putting bedding in the freezer for a certain amount of time and then removing them.
Oh, interesting. I guess that would really dry it out.
Yeah. And then I guess then you got both sides of the pillow or the cold side of the pillow. So win-win.
Okay, that's all I've got on dust mites for now, but we may come back to them later in the series. Yeah, who knows?
They may reemerge for sure.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Now, for the rest of this episode, I wanted to talk a little bit more about atmospheric dust, which we've already touched on. We've talked about the ways that the dust is floating around. It's stirred up easily by just movement through the atmosphere that we all live in, or, of course, by weather patterns and so forth. We've talked about how, you know, an individual particle of dust is often invisible to the naked eye, but in great volumes, it's different. And that great volume may be the great volume of dust on your dining room table when after you come back from traveling, or it could indeed be the great volumes of dust seen in a dust devil, or seen in a dust storm. Because again, dust is everywhere. It's suspended in the air. It's steadily accumulating on surfaces. And you know, we often don't notice it until it builds up to a certain threshold.
This is why it never seems like you need to dust until it's already too dusty.
Yeah, and at that point, you realize you're living foul and you've got to fix things. Now, atmospheric dust is important because, of course, it impacts both human health and climate, though, of course, these two topics overlap. Dust, according to the NOAA, is the single largest component of the aerosols in Earth's atmosphere. It likely has a huge impact on Earth's climate and affects everything from oceanic temperatures to snowmelt rates. There also seems to be a connection between dust and hurricanes, with data pointing to an inverse relationship between dust in the North Atlantic tropics and various Atlantic hurricanes. I was looking at a few different sources on all of this. One in particular, there's an NOAA article from 2016 titled The Dirt on Atmospheric Dust. And that 2016 stat is key because a little later I'm going to touch on some research that raises the question about like where we are in terms of our modeling of atmospheric dust and so forth. But based on this source, so it says that we're looking at somewhere between 205,000 teragrams of dust entering the atmosphere each year, with one teragram equaling 1 trillion grams.
My kitchen scale does not go up to a teragram.
There's also an estimated 20 teragrams of dust suspended in the atmosphere at any given time, with seasonal variations. Now, the amount of time that an individual dust particle remains in the air, that depends on particle size. Apparently, larger particles may remain suspended for no more than like 24 hours. But much smaller particles, they can stay aloft much longer. The period of time that the NOAA mentions in this article is 20 days or even more. Mm-hmm. Now, another figure I ran across, this is from Robert Monroe's Increased Atmospheric Dust Has Masked Power of Greenhouse Gases to Warm Planet from January 2023. This was published on the website of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and it puts it like this, quote, 26 million tons of such particles globally, equivalent to the weight of about 5 million African elephants floating in the sky.
I came across some numbers within the same range offered in the introduction to Jay Owen's book. So in the Dust book, she includes estimates that somewhere between, and this is a big range, but no matter what, this is a huge number, somewhere between 8 and 36 million metric tons of mineral dust are floating in the atmosphere at any given time. And I was trying to come up with a comparison for that number, looking for figures in that range. One I found was kind of interesting, not that it's all that easy to picture this, but just as a conceptual comparison, I found a paper published in PNAS from 2023 by Greenspoon et al. Called The Global Biomass of Wild Animals. And so the authors of this paper were just estimating for certain categories of animals and organisms on Earth, how much total biomass is there if you were to weigh them all at the same time. And the authors, based on their methodology, estimated that if you were to put together all of the wild land mammals on Earth, so all the mammals that are not domesticated, live out in the wild on land, there would be about 22 million metric tons worth. And a lot of those animals are going to be things like deer, wild pigs, elephants, and so forth. Mm-hmm. There would be about 22 million metric tons worth. And by the way, that number is quite small compared to the total biomass of humans. There would be 390 million metric tons of humans and 630 million worth of domestic and city-dwelling animals. But all of the wild land animals are about 22 million metric tons, which is sort of in the middle of Owens's 8 to 36 million metric tons of dust range. So that's a lot of dust in the air. It's kind of hard to imagine.
Yeah, yeah. And again, part of it is because it is just mostly invisible to us. And even when it's visible, it's hard to think in terms of, oh, that dust devil, that dust cloud. Even if you're looking at satellite imagery, maybe when you're looking at satellite imagery, you can sort of think in terms of millions and millions of elephants. Now, the next question you may ask, and a number of you already know the answer to this, I'm sure, is where does the dust come from? On the whole, it comes from the deserts. So according to, again, the NOAA in 2016, more than half of the world's atmospheric dust originates in North Africa. This is the Saharan connection that you've probably heard of, with the greater Saharan desert dust transport across the Atlantic having been linked to things like El Nino and other weather phenomena. So that's like half the dust, more or less, based on these measurements and estimations and models. The rest is thought to originate from other major desert regions around the world that share the right characteristics.
Well, what are those characteristics?
All right, so these are areas that sit in low elevation basins near or surrounded by mountains. And the mountains are key because these feed rivers, which deposit vast amounts of sediment into low-lying regions. So that makes these regions dust collecting and distribution engines for the atmosphere.
Okay.
Now, we should also point out that there are other like major dust engines. Certainly, if you have wildfires, we mentioned soot earlier, but also volcanoes.
Right.
When a volcano erupts, we've talked about this on the show before, it ejects vast amounts of volcanic dust into the atmosphere. And these ejections are often large enough to impact human health and human activity to varying degrees, and these are often visible from space.
So we've seen how the creation of atmospheric dust in some way depends on the complex interactions of other cycles and processes on the surface of the Earth, like the interaction of the water cycle and of water coming down from mountains and mixing correctly with the desert environments. And then, of course, that being affected by wind, which raises dust up into the air. It also works on the other end, too, right? Like dust, in turn, affects complicated processes all around the globe.
That's right. Again, just think of like the various, convection and system of movement of air throughout our atmosphere. And just imagine dust getting caught up in all of that, atmospheric dust has a few properties worth stressing in relation to climate and weather here. On one hand, there's the role played by dust particles in the formulation of water droplets. So these form when water vapor shifts to liquid form around a condensation nucleus, such as a particle of dust. And then these particles of dust with water condensing around it, these coalesce into clouds. And then all of these particles with water around these water droplets, they fall as rain, and this whole cycle continues. And if you've ever, absorbed any material about how raindrops work and so forth, you've probably heard about this.
So to some extent, dust quite literally makes it rain.
Yeah. And then there's the fact that atmospheric dust can have apparently both a cooling and warming effect on the planet. And temperature, of course, plays a vital role in climate and weather as well. But the exact net effect of dust, warming or cooling, this seems to remain a complex topic of discussion. But one of the people that has been studying this, I was looking at stuff that this person has said and written and also articles about their work. This is Jasper Koch, a UCLA assistant professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. And according to Koch here, dust can have either a net cooling or net heating effect on the atmosphere, depending on the size of the particles.
Ah, okay.
So in the cooling scenario, and recent studies may point, it seems, and Koch seems to indicate this as well, to a slight overall cooling effect, you have dust particles reflecting sunlight back into space and also dissipating high clouds that warm the planet. Now, on the warming side of the whole scenario, dust landing on the surface of the planet again, it can coat your car, it can coat your dinner table and so forth, but it also can coat snow and ice with dark particles that increases the absorption of heat.
Ah, okay, that's right. So if it was just pure snow or ice, it would reflect more of the sun's energy back out into space. But if you cover it with something darker in color, it will just warm it up.
Right. And Koch has also pointed out that dust can also cool the planet by depositing key nutrients like iron and phosphorus into the ocean to support the growth of CO2-absorbing phytoplankton. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are all these different ways that dust interacts with climate. And it seems like there are warming properties that can go on, there are cooling properties. And it may be that it's a little more in the cooling category, at least right now.
But if I understand you right, you're saying that there's enough uncertainty there that that's sort of a low confidence conclusion.
There's the more that I look at it, the more that it seems like we're still learning a lot more about how dust works in the atmosphere and exactly like what our data sets are and what the modeling looks like. Mm-hmm. But Koch's main point here, and this is reflected in the Monroe article I referenced earlier, is that this is not an argument for, okay, this is what we need to do to combat climate change or reverse it or the reverse of this, you know. It's not some sort of like weird geohacking scheme or whatever, but rather it's about identifying, because we've probably discussed some of these before, and you run across these where it's like, all right, what we need to do, we need to pump X number of particles, you know, how many tons of particles into the atmosphere to carry out some sort of a cooling effect to counteract global warming.
That is not being advocated here.
Right. Rather, the point here is that we need to identify to what degree atmospheric dust levels may impact and even mask the effects of global warming. And it's key, since microscopic airborne particles created by burning fossil fuels are, of course, a huge aspect of human-caused climate change. But those very particles could also temporarily be contributing to cooling. So we need to be aware of all this so that, first of all, we know the degree to which climate change is occurring and isn't masked by the effects of the dust in the atmosphere. And then also we need to be aware of this if we do hopefully ratchet down on our fossil fuel consumption. You know, we're likely going to see some sort of dip in the cooling effect there, or the specific cooling effect caused by the dust particles that are created via the burning of fossil fuels. Now, satellites can detect dust in the atmosphere, but I was reading about how this doesn't mean it's necessarily always easy to detect. It can apparently be quite challenging, but the results can also be very impressive, very informative. Apparently, there's still a lot of discussion over how much dust there is and how it impacts everything. I was looking at a 2024 article in the Washington Post by Aaron Blakemore. And this is on a pair of recent studies that challenge the North African dust emission dominance view that we referenced earlier, and instead argue that dust emissions may vary by season and across hemispheres, and that the total worldwide dust emission level might actually be much lower than previously thought. So that would mean our older models may be in need of some update. And I believe the issues we've just discussed here concerning climate and fossil fuel usage, I mean, these are still extremely valid, but this is another example of how we need more research, we need better data sets, better tracking. All this is probably needed to get a handle on the exact impact and variance of Earth's atmospheric dust.
So despite common symbolic themes, on a global scale, dust is the opposite of insignificant. It has large-scale ramifications, and we need to understand them better in how dust affects climate, weather, water, all of that.
Yeah, human health, and then, you know, to get into the dust mites as well, allergens and so forth. Yeah, so it's like dust at the beginning, dust at the end, and then just dust all in between as well. You know, making it rain, making it hot or cold, making us sick, making us feel like our house is a bit foul and needs to be cleaned up, all of these things.
All right. Well, maybe we should call part one there, but we will be back with more to say about dust next time.
That's right. There's a lot to discuss regarding dust. We didn't get into cosmic dust at all. I'm sure we'll get into that. We already have some topics lined up involving, you know, philosophical and mythological treatments of dust. So expect more of that as well. In the meantime, I'll remind everyone that Stuff to Blow Your Mind is primarily a science and culture podcast with core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On Mondays, we do listener mail. On Wednesdays, we do a short form episode. On Fridays, we set aside Most Serious Concerns to just talk about a weird movie on Weird House Cinema. And indeed, more than one movie we've watched, quite a few movies have involved evil creatures turning to dust. I think we just watched one a couple of weeks ago where this happened at the end.
Which one was this?
Was this Wolf Woman? The villain turns to dust, and then a wind suddenly blows all the dust away.
Yeah, Wolf Devil Woman. Yeah, the evil demon at the end like turns into soot.
Yeah. So there's plenty of dust on Weird House as well.
And then it doesn't tell you if the main character lives or not. She just like is getting kind of woozy, and then the cuts to the end.
The end. Yeah. So that's the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. And hey, just remind everyone out there, if you like what we're doing here, one thing you can do to help us out is rate and review us wherever you get you have the power to do so. Give us a nice array of stars, a little sprinkling of dust there, if you will. It helps us out. And if you have any thoughts on this topic, about past topics, future topic possibilities, write in and let us know. We would love to hear from you. And email is the best way to get in touch with us directly.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.